Case this morning, International Union versus ZF Bogue. Try this time.
Good morning, Your Honors. This case is about bottom adherence to contractual commitments. When unions and employers voluntarily agree to enter into negotiations midterm of an existing labor agreement, national labor policy ought to encourage such efforts. I don't represent employers. My practice is on the union side, but it's been my experience almost totally that employers do not willy-nilly approach unions midterm of contract seeking to change a contract absent existing exigent compelling circumstances. When an employer midterm of an agreement seeks to engage a union in midterm negotiations, national labor policy ought to encourage good faith negotiations when unions agree to do so. In an ironic sense, I find the district court's position here and the defendant's position here will disserve the interests of employers. How so? Unions, under the approach and result in this case advocated by the defendant and adopted by the district court, unions will be highly unlikely in the future to want to meet employers who may have legitimate needs to approach the union to renegotiate terms of a contract. Unions will have serious second thoughts about doing that. And in that sense, that is a result which not only disserves national labor policy, but disserves the interests of employers. And I don't represent employers, but I recognize that employers oftentimes have compelling needs to renegotiate midterm. In this case, in the spring of 2007, the employer approached the union, Local 2343, down in Paris, Illinois, seeking to change the agreement in such a way that if those changes were implemented, there would be a commitment that the Paris, Illinois facility would be chosen as the surviving facility. Those are not my words. Those are the words the employer published to the bargaining committee and to the members of the union. The district court seriously and grievously erred in its analysis by making all sorts of factual findings about the meaning and intent of the agreement. I needn't go over for the court the standards in a Rule 56 motion. That's boilerplate. But let me take just one simple example of how the district court absolutely ignored the surrounding circumstances and intent of the parties to create surviving obligations that would survive post-main contract expiration. It is clear that the whole premise of the spring 2007 midterm negotiations was to enter into an agreement that might change the employer's mind or influence the employer's mind to select Paris as the survivor as compared to the non-union facility in Hebron, Kentucky. That wasn't ever spelled out in the agreement except as follows. They used some buzzwords. That's on the agreement that was signed on June 25, 2007, appendix page 25, in critical part, used a shorthand phrase. It said, none of these items will be implemented unless Paris is the plant chosen to remain, quote, in operation after the consolidation, unquote. Well, a court sitting here without knowing the surrounding circumstances would know what the parties were talking about. But when the parties at the table, they understood what that meant. They understood that Paris would be the survivor, those were the employer's word, if those changes were implemented. And they were. And the consolidation, everybody understood, was going to last 3 to 4 years. That's what the employer said. That was the premise of the whole negotiations. They used that as buzzword. However, the employer had second thoughts, regretted its deal, buyer's remorse. It obtained the benefits of the June 2007 agreement, and when the main CBA, collective bargaining agreement, expired, it repudiated its obligation. And that's what brings us here. I needn't comment further about the judge's Rule 56 errors. That's covered in our brief. There are numerous other examples of how the court, the district court, invaded the province of the jury. But the critical thing is there is no inherent meaning to the word after the consolidation that the parties chose unless one goes to the surrounding circumstances, which shows the parties' intent to create surviving obligations.
What, in your view, are those surrounding circumstances?
Surrounding circumstances are, one, the employer said that it, in 2007, had to make a decision as to which of the two plants would survive after the consolidation. And that is the grounds upon which the union membership voted to engage in midterm negotiations. There are contemporaneous statements and publications of the employers saying that if the changes are implemented, Paris would be the survivor. Your Honors, it is undisputed. Paris never was the survivor. It is defunct, kaput. The union never obtained what it was promised by the employer. I hope that answered your question.
Just a question before you sit down about remedy here. You want a trial on that, what I understand your argument to be latent ambiguity in the contracts, and the remedy you're seeking is a compensation for the concessions that were made?
No. Well, we're seeking damages for let me start at the reverse. We're seeking specific performance, the benefits of the bargain, that the plant be reopened, the plant be put in operation, the plant be made the survivor. The derivative would be the lost wages that the employees sustained by reason of the employer failing to fulfill its commitment to make Paris the survivor.
Is there an indefinite obligation on the part of the company to keep that plant in Paris?
No. No, never. Never has been our position, Your Honor.
Well, what is the limitation principle?
The limitation is solely that if the employer decided to close a plant, assuming the concessions were implemented, if those conditions occur, then the plant that had to be closed was Hebron, Kentucky, not Paris. That's not an indefinite concession. It's not an indefinite commitment. We're not, and hypothetically only, if the employer closed Hebron and then Paris became economically non-viable, it could close Paris too, assuming it's fulfilled its other obligations to bargain in good faith. No, there's never been a commitment that this
could
is...
Could it ever close Paris and keep Hebron open?
I might have to ask Your Honor a question to assume I'm not sure of the premise of your question, Mike. I'll answer it as best I can. Under these circumstances, when in June and July of 2007 it implemented the concessions and announced that Hebron was to be closed and began the process of closing Hebron, those became vested benefits. And Hebron had to be closed because that's what the employer, by its own actions, recognized its commitment was to be.
Mr. Roberts?
May it please the court, I think we would argue that the district court correctly interpreted the contract as a matter of law. He focused on some language that counsel ignores, which is Article 29 of the agreement, which says that notwithstanding anything else in this agreement, no acts, events, or omissions occurring before the initial date or after the termination date of the agreement shall give rise to any rights or liabilities under this agreement, nor shall it be subject to arbitration. So this is a case where we have explicit language in the contract, explicit no vesting language. The parties understood that the obligations under the agreement would survive only to the extent that the contract survived. Of course, what happened in this case is that the parties entered into their negotiations midterm negotiations in 2007, but those midterm negotiations focused only on six limited items. Everything else in the contract was left unaffected. So they agreed to these six items, modifying the agreement. So you, at that point, you were a year and a half away from the expiration of the contract. The company announced this.
Suppose after the contract had expired, the union brought up in later negotiations one of the concession subjects that under the interim agreement is not to be brought up in the next round of bargaining. Would they be in violation of the interim agreement by bringing those up?
Well, after the agreement expired, there wouldn't have been any continuing obligations. But during the negotiations that occurred in February and March and early April before the contract expired, if either party had insisted, I don't know that bringing it up would have been a problem, but insisted to impasse that there that had to be changed, then yes. But what our position would be...
Some part of this contract.
I'm sorry?
Some part of this contract has an afterglow after the expiration of the 2007 agreement. You were in collective bargaining with these folks for a new agreement after the expiration of the collective bargaining.
Yeah, there was a strike. This contract expired on April 6th of 08, and the union went on strike.
Right.
Came back on the 21st. There was some negotiations after the agreement, but the negotiations after the agreement were focused on decision bargaining, whereas the company, in light of the strike, the inability to reach a new labor agreement that would provide peace.
I understand, but hypothetically, if at that point in bargaining after the expiration of the agreement, the union brought up and wanted to bargain to impasse on one of the matters that had been contractually decided was not going to be on the table the next time around, would they be in breach of the interim agreement?
Well, I don't think they could have compelled the employer to agree or to reach impasse on an item if they were bargaining for a new contract. The bargaining that actually took place after the contract expired was of a different type. It was no longer for a new contract. It was decision bargaining over the closure. Under the National Labor Relations Act, there was an obligation to bargain over the decision.
My point is, there was something you agreed to do or not to do after the expiration of the 2007 contract.
Items
were off the table.
They were off the table during the negotiations that were preceding that. I would not necessarily say to the extent that we were agreeing on a new contract, they weren't going to be changed in the new contract. The problem is that we never reached a new agreement, and nothing in this case or nothing in this in the law or in the contract compelled that the parties would reach a new agreement.
But negotiations did continue toward a new contract during the strike after the expiration of the old CBA.
Well, there was some discussion. It was kind of running in parallel tracks to some extent, that they were discussing the possibility of a new agreement, and at the same time, the employer was announcing the change in the decision and bargaining over the decision. So to some extent.
So the answer is yes. Negotiations continued after the expiration of the agreement, and so the answer to Judge Ripple's inquiry about whether the portions of the 2007 side agreement that were favorable to you, you would have asserted, and
well, the six
just
items,
not those that were unfavorable to you?
Well, no, the six items of that agreement, which were pensions, 401K, the shift overlap, the job selection, two other items, I think, were small. Those were not subject to change if the parties reached
a
new agreement.
So you're taking the position that that part of the 2007 agreement survived, but the part about the plant closing did not.
Well, I'm taking the position that the items that were agreed to were the six items I just mentioned. The agreement was that if we implemented these, that they would select Paris, and they did select Paris. But then the assumption was that there would be a new agreement, and of course there was never a new agreement. If there had been a new agreement, then the parties, presumably those six items and presumably Paris would have continued as the selected facility. But our position is that...
Well, how is that clear from the agreements themselves? It sounds like you're conceding that there's a latent ambiguity here based on the objective circumstances of the negotiation.
No, I wouldn't be conceding that, because I think the notwithstanding language that I cited earlier, the notwithstanding anything else in this agreement, makes it clear that there were no continuing obligations after the contract expired. There was no rights or liabilities could arise out of that agreement.
Right, on the face of the agreements, but the whole idea of a latent ambiguity is that objective surrounding circumstances make an otherwise patently unambiguous a set of contract provisions ambiguous in context.
Well, I would argue in response to that, Your Honor, that there's nothing in that 2007 agreement that stated that these obligations would continue beyond.
Right. What about the objective surrounding circumstances, though?
Well, I think the objective surrounding circumstances were that this was a midterm modification of the agreement.
Right, and the union refused to even enter into this midterm modification without the assurance from the company that the concessions reached during those midterm negotiations would not be implemented unless Paris were selected as the surviving facility.
That's correct.
Right. But and they weren't bargaining for just a statement from you, a hollow statement from you that Paris would be selected unless you decided otherwise, which is what happened here.
I think that the notion that they didn't get anything out of this, I think, is wrong, because the parties did get, at the very least, they got another year of survivability that they would not have had if the parties had reached an agreement. And I think the assumption was when the parties entered in 2007 that they would likely reach a new agreement in April of 2008. They did not. And what we're saying is that the language in this and the presumption, the basic presumption that the obligations would not continue, that in conjunction with this explicit language, which trumps, in our view, anything else that may have been ambiguous in the contract, it's hard to see how that language, if that means anything. And then the other point I'd make quickly is that let's assume that is the case, that there's latent ambiguity and that this obligation continued. The union still had an obligation then, because that would have... If the obligation continued, our argument is, and then the grievance procedure would have continued, there were contractual remedies that they could have sought, and they didn't pursue those. And there is a legal obligation to exhaust your contractual remedies. And what we're saying is that you can't have it both ways. You can't say that the obligation continues, but yet you had no obligation to pursue your contractual remedies. And it's undisputed that they did not pursue their contractual remedies. And so we would argue that even if they're right on the latent ambiguity, and even if the obligation somehow continued, that their failure to exhaust the contractual remedies would bar this suit, because a federal lawsuit under Section 301 is a last resort. It's not the parties are supposed to, you know, try to resolve their disputes through their own internal contractual mechanisms, and in this case...
Right, but I think you're missing the point that although the collective bargaining agreement with its grievance procedures and so forth that are the premise for your exhaustion argument expired, the 2007 modification had continuing obligations, but only that. Agreement had continuing obligations, that the rest of the contract, including the grievance procedures, expired.
Well, I think I don't think that would be accurate legally, because even after a contract expires, the Supreme Court has held that if the obligation arises out of the agreement, which is what you're saying here, if it's vested in some manner, then the obligation to arbitrate continues, or the obligation to follow grievance procedures. So I would just disagree, Your Honor, with that you could just take a limited obligation and continue it and then say there's no obligation to pursue it.
This is your side agreement argument.
Basically. That's the alternative argument. Mm-hmm. All right, thank you.
Pardon?
1.5 minutes.
I shall be so bold as to try to address Judge Ripple's question, which opposing counsel had very difficult time skirting about bargaining about the six items post-contract expiration. The answer is the union did try to do that. During the post-contract negotiations, the record reveals that the union was asked to restore the pension, and the company refused, citing the 2007 agreement. We know that the company indeed recognized post-contract negotiation in the spring of 2008 that those obligations under the 2000 agreement did survive, and therefore the union was precluded from negotiating that item because they specifically asked to restore it, and the company said, no, look, you're bound by the 2007 agreement.
What about this exhaustion argument?
Yeah, those are two separate ideas. I think your question, if I might be so bold, your question was right on point in implying that there is a separate obligation under that was created on the defendant to make Paris the survivor, independent of the expiration of the arbitration language under the agreement. The Supreme Court decision to which I think counsel is referring, Nolde v. Drake Bakeries and a few others, those are just presumptions of the survivability of arbitration. Here there is forceful evidence that the parties in the master agreement, in the main CBA, specifically excluded from arbitration anything that happens on or after the termination date of the agreement. It's excluded from arbitration. The union had no ability to arbitrate, and they admitted that in the district court.
There's a reference, this is just a matter of curiosity, reference to Germans in some of the briefing. What is they have some ownership in the?
I understand. Yeah, the certainly leave that to counsel. I believe the ultimate owner upstream, several corporate levels up, would be a German corporation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.